now my privilege to introduce, tonight's speaker. We're doing things a little bit differently tonight. We're going to try out, we're going to do a question and answer session with Bill H. and Billy B. So let's give it up for Billy.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatzman.
Billy, alcoholic.
I'm really excited about this because when I called Billy and asked him if he would come and share some of his experience with our group, he said that he really wasn't too excited about the idea of standing up and talking on his own, telling his own story. He said rather he would really welcome the idea to answer some questions. And we've had a format concept that we've wanted to try here for some time and just never really had the opportunity, and we're gonna do that tonight. So it's something we call a Conversations with a Drunk, and
yeah.
And Billy is the original Bridge Street drunk, I believe.
Yeah, for sure.
Billy may not remember this, but at my first meeting here in Visalia, right after I was back home from treatment, was Monday night at the Christ Lutheran Church on Tulare Avenue. It was a 7 o'clock book study, and after the meeting, Billy was the first guy who came over to me and asked me if he could be helpful and gave me his phone number. And I thought it was really peculiar that guys were giving guys phone numbers in AA. Anyway, that's a special piece of my past with Billy. So we're going to start off asking him a few questions. And one of the things that might get us started off is, can you tell us a little bit about what was going on, man? I mean, when you got here, when you came to your first meeting, you know, was the heat on, man?
Well, at that time, I think I was involved with my third conviction of drunk driving. But we used to have a lot of those, what we called, in those days, they give you a lot of slack. I had a lot of reckless. But I valued my driver's license for whatever reason. I think it was just raised in California. If you don't have a driver's license, they were attempting to take it away again for the second time. I initiated going to a DUI class. It was supposed to be a 6 month program. I aced it in 18 months. but it took me a while to get through it. Anyway, that was when I talk about it, when I was separated from alcohol. That was not my first time to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had previous invitations to come, and I think one of those was like four. I needed four signatures, and the other one maybe I needed six, just to get through it. And I was pretty good about getting a couple of signatures and forging the rest. So those wasn't serious attempts to be sober, but I finally did. About 4 years prior to this being separated from alcohol, I made a commitment to get sober and swearing off forever, I guess it's in the book. And it didn't work out, so I had given up hope. But when I met the director of this program, she was a sober alcoholic. She told me, I did kind of a step two. She told me that she had introduced the ideal to me that God would help me to stay sober. I'd given up hope. I was living in what you call an alcoholic purgatory. That's a miserable place to live, I don't know how I survived it, but she instilled in me that a higher power could help me get sober, and I processed that idea, I processed that thought, and I had a spiritual awakening. As I'll give this one more shot, and I didn't think this thing was going to work out, but I'm still on that journey. from that very same day. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wasn't enthralled about, all I wanted to do was stay sober. I wasn't enthralled in introducing myself to the program, but I kept coming. When the chips were down, that's in the literature somewhere, when the chips were down, I would resort to the big book. I would resort to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned this program a piece at a time and started applying it to my life a piece at a time. I hear people say they did the program backwards, and I think I might have been one of those. You know, but I eventually started applying all these steps to my life, and it's made a big difference in the way that I think. It's taken away a lot of the calamity, a lot of the anger, a lot of the stuff by utilizing the steps in my life.
Well, tell me what do you mean by doing the steps backwards?
Well, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that a long time before I made that commitment. I might not have admitted that my life was unmanageable, but I thought I was doomed to do that. All I wanted to do was stay sober, because I had so many experiences about sobering up. You know, I used to call it going on a wagon. I used to have, I'd get the heat off my back, and I was able to make money. And, you know, if I stayed sober, I thought that my life was under control, but it wasn't, you know. Because I still had the alcoholism, and I didn't understand that part of it. I just thought it was all about the physical parts, and I didn't understand all that other calamity that was going on. You know, later on I found out when I got into the book, there's a part in there where Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were 12-stepping the man on the bed, Bill Dobson, and they explain how alcohol deteriorates the body and warps the mind. And I knew about the deterioration of the body because my body had really been deteriorated. I was 42 years old when I separated from alcohol. And I had, the last 5 or 6 years, I had lost a lot of weight. This color was throwing up all the time. Had the DTs if I didn't drink on a regular basis. But I didn't know about this warping of the mind, and an alcoholic. I later learned that I had to treat that, and it took me probably 5 or 6 years before. You know, I did a superficial 4-step in probably the second year I was sober with a friend of mine, but it took me a while to understand that I had to go a little bit further, find out to really start practicing steps 11, really start getting into doing steps 8, 6, 7, and 8, identifying my character defects, being able to do that, identifying my character defects, doing steps 8 and 9, making amends to people, finding out my patterns with my relationships with other people, attacking those resentments. I had a lot of mentors in Alcoholics Anonymous that I used to listen to. I have some, at least one that's been around a long time, is sitting here right in this room, and every time he comes to a meeting where I'm at, I'm always tuned in to him. There's several others that, you know, they give me some little nuggets about how to attack this anger and hatred and resentment and garbage and calamity that was inside my head. And only the steps can do that. I had a lot of conditions, you know, might be some veterans in here that had to do with other stuff going on in my head. And these steps, at least for me, these steps have allowed that to clear up. You know, I'm a lot more calmer than I used to be. I still have my moments, and I'm not a doormat. I know how to say no. And I can say no harshly, you know. And
so Billy's 32 years sober this year, and I want to take you back to 1986 when you were separated from alcohol, as you said. And what did you think of us? What did you think of AA at that time?
I picked out the. I did everybody's inventory. I didn't participate in Alcoholics Anonymous the way that, you know, I love to talk one-on-one, and I love to ask to get the guys that I talk with to talk about the winners. I would, you know, the ones that had the answers. I would go and ask them questions. I talk a lot one-on-one. If you said something to me, I trusted the book. That was the first suggestion that I got. That lady that day, September the 7th, 1986, she suggested that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she also suggested that I get the big book. And I made that mission that day. I had that book in my hand within an hour, and it became my companion. But anything that any alcoholic said to me about anything in the program, I would research and verify that in the book. And if you were telling me something that wasn't in that book, I had a tendency to discard your information. But if you were sticking to the book, well, then I would road test what you had to say. Maybe not right away, but someplace down the line, I would grab a hold of that and try it out. And I learned that this stuff works for guys like me. You know, the actual program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's still a lot of misinformation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And love and tolerance. But I process it. And I was in that same spot. One of the things that it came up in the meeting, I just left it. I have a right to be wrong, because there's a lot of things that I believe that were entirely wrong when I got here. Sometimes I would change my mind. I would say something one week and say something different the next week, because I learned in the meantime that what I was talking about wasn't right. So, you know, we grow. I know I had survival tools. I was a street hustler. I mean, you know, I was, I had drank myself down to that where I got out of the Navy in 1975. Basically, I didn't exist as far as the world was concerned until about 1987. I just, no credit and no visible means of support. But I went through a lot of money. I went through a whole lot of money. I knew how to make money out there. And so I had these little survival techniques that I used. And what I did over a period of time, when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was still using those survival techniques. I used them for quite a while. Eventually, I replaced my survival street techniques with the techniques of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they work a whole lot better. You don't have to watch your back all the time. You don't have to be scared all the time. You don't have to be angry, and you give people a lot more love, patience. You don't have to, you know, when I know somebody's lying to me or bullshitting me, it don't even make me mad anymore. I just take it in, because that's where I was too. You know, that's where I came from.
So let's park here at 1986, just another moment. At that time, did you think you were an alcoholic?
And, I knew that.
Did you know what it meant?
I didn't think I knew that I was trapped in alcoholism, because in 1982 I tried to get sober. I was on a binge, and I ended up in a VA hospital. First thing I had to do with the federal government since I left the Navy in 1975 was in 82 they took me in there on a stretcher. I detoxed a couple of days. They wanted to put me in a program. I didn't want to have nothing to do with that. I figured I could do this thing on my own. I said, okay, I'm not going to drink no more. That was what self-commitment. I escaped from the hospital. And a couple of months later, for no reason at all, I walked into one of my favorite water holes and ordered a shivers on the rock, and there was nothing going on bad that day. that's called a subtle insanity of the first drink. I had nothing to drink over. No reason to drink at all. And the next day I woke up behind that saloon sitting there. A friend of mine brought me out a tall scotch and water, handed it to me, and I looked at it and I said, what's the use? And I've heard that a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous. What's the use? I've heard it so many times since then. And I thought I would never get sober. I thought I was doomed to die drunk. And I stayed that way for 4 more years, just making the best of it. I knew that alcohol had me, and just trying to make the best of it. That's all I did.
Sounds like you really captured the idea of hopeless there. What got you to a place, or do you remember what was going on when you conceded that you needed help?
I knew I needed help. I didn't think it was in the cards. I'm a gambler, and I just didn't think that was going to happen to me. And that when I had that 1 hour conversation with that lady, she talked about her drinking, and she kept asking me about mine. And you know, she was on the state's dime for the first hour. They were paying her to talk to me. And then she talked to me another 15 minutes. She was on her dime then. You know, she wasn't on the state's dime. That last 15 minutes, she said some things to me that I've never had to take a drink again. You know, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't think this thing was going to work. And I've shared this many times. I said, if I could, along this journey, I said, if I could stay sober for 5 years, I'm giving the whole world a break, especially my kids, especially my mother. I'm giving the world a break. I always thought I would go back to drink. But after 5 years, I was convinced that this thing was going to work for me. You know, I still had some problems out there. I had a couple of times where, I was kind of homicidal. But my mother, bless her sweetheart, I was 21 years sober when she passed away. And my mother didn't think I would stay sober until I celebrated my 20th year. And she got the ideal that AA was working. She had less confidence in me than I did. So that's just one for the books.
Well, let's go ahead and move forward just a little bit. So tell us about some of your experiences. Did you do a 90 meeting in 90 day kind of thing?
No, I was doing maybe one a week, and then it really fell off. One of the things that happened to me is I had some talents in the gaming industry. I had developed that 11 years of living in bars and casinos and card rooms and all of that. I developed some talents that I didn't know existed. So I had some extremely good things that happened to me after I sobered up. My body healed up, and I was able to work in some places in Nevada, Reno, Las Vegas. Made a trip to Louisiana, worked a poker tournament back there. Worked at some. Just make a lot of money. My health got better. I was able to eat steaks. Imagine that. For about 3 years before I sobered up, I couldn't eat no meat without throwing up right away. I mean, it's like burning. A lot of good things was happening to me. So I was a workaholic and an alcoholic. So I would say that I had to do the meetings with the program for that 18 months, the meetings that was required for that. And then I just did meetings periodically when I was working. So when I married one of my old drinking partners in about 4 years of sobriety, that didn't work out really well. And when I went through that little escapade, I got involved with the 10-step group here in Visalia, and with my sponsor, and we all started doing what we call a redoing the 4 steps, and come up with this little diagram. We researched all the columns in the 4th step, and I started putting down names of people that I really didn't like very much. Used to have to pray for them all the time. Put down their names here, and then I put down these columns, and then I discovered in the fourth step what they call the fourth column. We had to drop the word blame and look for our own faults in page 67. Boy, I was talking about that earlier. That was a big problem for me to be able just to look at my part in it. Disregard the other person entirely. And then my sponsor at the time, he suggested that we look for patterns. And I was able to establish a lot of patterns with my relationships with a lot of different people. But when I looked at these patterns, I also began, the patterns helped me to identify my grosser character defects, the ones that was the insoluble goods that they talk about, the things that I needed to get rid of, the things that we're talking about step six, identifying the things I need to discard from my life that was really causing me a lot of damage in my relationships with other people. And step seven was just simply asking my higher power to remove those. Just that simple. But keep working on it. You know, just keep working. I'm one of those people that I had to do a lot of incessant prayer, repeated prayer. Pray. You know, there's the one I call the resentment prayer. It's on page 552 in the third edition. It's in the story of Freedom from Bondage. And it's, for some reason, it's one of the stories they left in, and they left it exactly on the same page when they went to the fourth edition, you know. And you're asking for the people that you'd rather see and discarded from the world. You pray for their good health, prosperity, and happiness. Oh, yes, 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 yes. I just love to pray for all those people. But because I was a prisoner to all those people. I was a prisoner to all those people. I had to get them out of my head, so it took a lot of work. And I don't try to let people get in that head anymore. The expression a lot of you guys was using, they were there rent-free and burning my life up. You know, I don't need that, and I don't want that. It's been a long time since I've really had that kind of disregard for another human. And I don't need to get caught up in that anymore. It's not fun. It's not fun at all. If you're there, it worked for me. I hope it could work for you. That I hope you don't have to pray as hard as I did, because I was a pretty sick person. When I had a resentment, I could hang on to it really strong.
So let's talk about sponsorship. Did you get one immediately? How many have you had?
Well, I used her for a while. Mm-hmm. All right. And then I was going to meetings in Las Vegas. I was going to meetings in Reno. I was going to meetings at a place called Saturday Night Live in San Jose, because I ended up working there for 6 years in a casino restaurant up there called the Garden City. Right in the Silicon Valley in the 90s. And, you know, I was a very fortunate guy. I would sit down at these tables, and these tech people that was living up there making all that cash in the 90s were just throwing money at me all the time. What a life that was. For 6 years, you know. I was very fortunate. It's probably about the best job a person could have without a college education. Anyway, and I would go to the Alano Club. I had three or four guys at the Alano Club here in Visalia, too, that I paid attention to. David Looper, my friend Jim here, right here. And I appreciate that man. I've listened to him for a long time. Paul H. Curtis Jones. Oh, man. Curtis would always, he would, when I would come at him asking him about something, and he would give me an answer that didn't even have anything to do with what I was asking about. I was sniveling about my kids all being locked up in prison and all that stuff, and And he says to me, if there's no forgiveness for others, there's no forgiveness for yourself. I remember that one. I had to inventory that too, you know. Angry with my kids, them being locked up. What it was really about was that they were making me look bad. I had to inventory that.
Yes.
You know, you'd just be surprised what you can discover about. My kids are supposed to be in college, not prison. You know? Yeah. Had to take another look at myself and say, well, maybe I had something to do with them getting in prison. You know? I had to take another look at myself.
So let's shift topics a little bit. Let's talk about the word God. Did that scare you, or were you raised in a religious household?
I was raised at a Pentecostal church. It's located between Highway 198 and Farmersville Boulevard here. It was my mother's church. She used to take me to church about at least three times a week, and up till I was rebelled about 14, I guess. And I thought prayer was for the preacher, my grandmother, and my mother. I never thought that, you know, I was supposed to do any praying. I didn't start praying until I come here, and you guys taught me these prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other one, one of the prayers I use, I love the St. Francis prayer. It's I've said that all day long sometimes, just to get out of my head. But I use the 23rd Psalms now. I use the seventh step prayer, the third step prayer. Use it a lot. I use the one on page 552. It said the instructions when it comes to prayer, it says we can adjust them to our own use. And I do a lot of that. You know, and I got a series of prayers that I say every day because I have to. It's kind of like taking a shower inside my head. I have to do that. It really is. It's clean. It gets me started, you know. And I it clears out where then I can listen to other people. And there's another thing about spirituality. I think some of you know J.C. He comes up with this little thing that he called it. He says, talking about spirituality in Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of like talking about the curved part of a basketball. The whole program is spiritual, whether we believe it. The founding principle is one alcoholic talking to another. Dr. Bob, he talked about in his little pamphlet, the thing that he talked about, of course, the Sermon on the Mount, the chapter in the Corinthians about love, and the book of James. The book of James is not that long. So I've read these things. And in there's a place in the book of James that says where it talks about the greatest love you can have is laying down your life for your friends. And I heard that when I was a kid, and I thought it meant something entirely different than what it really means. And that's what we do when we share in Alcoholics Anonymous. We share our faults one with another. It comes from the book of James. That's what we're doing. That's a spiritual principle. One alcoholic talking to another. You know, if you're new, and when I'm talking to somebody new, I say, if you've got some kind of religious belief that you believe in, I tell them, I said, hang on to it. You're going to need it. If it's working for you in your life, you hang on to that. You can use that. But other than that, this thing is a lot simpler than we know. The things that we're doing, the physical actions that we're taking in Alcoholics Anonymous, one alcoholic talking to another, that's spiritual. You know, it's that simple. It's suiting up, showing up, making coffee, getting a service position. That's one of the things that I heard a lot of people that had long-term sobriety. Get a home group, get a sponsor, have a service position. Because the alcoholic mind, you have to keep it disciplined. If you don't, you're going to end up in chaos up here. You know, so that's what I do. Is and it's easy. It's fun. You know. One member talked about like wearing this program like a loose garment. You don't have to. You don't have to force feed yourself. You just do it as God allows you to. You're never late to a meeting. You're always on God's time. But you just move as the way that He allows you.
Let's talk about inventory. Your first one, was it, we've heard people talk about a moral inventory and an immoral inventory. Did you do yours by the book?
I don't think so. I didn't have the guidance. I filled out those columns and wrote down. I heard all that stuff about having to write down doing a long story. And so I did that with this friend of mine. And we did a lot of telephone work, me and him did. The inventory that I, where I really got into the inventory, where it's talking about finding my patterns, is I would take a list of 10 people, because, you know, I would write down 10 people, and then I would inventory each one of them, and then I would find the patterns of what my character defects was. This is really was valuable to me. I'm not that complicated a person. I thought I was. I had all this garbage, I couldn't put it together. But if I could inventory 3 or 4 people and see the patterns and eliminate those type of defects that was caused me, I'm talking about column 4. The instincts, it's important to understand the instincts is vital. And on the bottom of page, and this took about 5 or 6 years, and there was a group of us doing these things together. And Paul helped me with this quite a bit, because I would listen to him talk every Saturday for an hour, and I still listen to him on Sunday evening at 5 o'clock. Still listen to him. He drives a lot of people insane, you know. So, but the thing about it is he has the ability to get up and talk about himself and demonstrate an inventory to you, and I have a lot of the same problems that he has. It's his story is different than mine, but all he's doing is demonstrating how it works. You know, how I, and but when it really comes down to it, I have to find what my character defect is and be willing to get rid of that. The most vital thing that I discovered, I think it's on page 70, it said, we have to get rid, if we continue to harm others, we'll probably drink again. So any character defect, if I'm harming another human being, now I can do it, but I call it, I have to live with the blowback from that. I have to live with it now. Sometimes, is it worth it? Sometimes we think so. You know, if she looks just right. You know, but there were some commitments I made to myself that there was roads that I wouldn't go down anymore. And I found out it was real healthy for me to make those decisions, to do things different than I did before. It's not to get, I hear the word they use today is called troll. I get invited into these situations where I think that, I'm tempted to go down that. I get lust or I get envious or I get pissed off and I tempt to go down that road. I say, hey, I can't go there. And I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I don't have to go to every fight that I'm invited to. I don't have to chase every girl that's a 10. That's, you know, if she's involved with somebody else or if I'm involved with somebody else, that's a road that, you know, I have to put up a stop sign. I don't go down because I'm going to pay a price for that. If I'm willing to pay the price. And it says in the book that if we continue to harm others, we'll probably drink again. That could be the price that I end up paying for that. But I don't want all that anger. That's, there's, you know, in my head.
So you're talking about defects. You're stepping right down the path here, right? Did you find any defects that you didn't know that you had?
Did I find defects that I didn't know? I had hidden motives. I had hidden motives. A lot of hidden motives. But that sometimes that takes a little longer because we think we know why we do things, and sometimes we don't. We don't really know why we do things. I thought I was mad at my boys because they were in prison. That's an example that I use. I was really angry with them because they made me look bad. Boy. A lot of us, you know, the fear, that's where they come under the fear. The fear of looking bad. And there's a lot of, you know, they're driven by 100 forms of fear. Those instincts that I was talking about. And they're really vital. They're important. It was important for me. Because I found out that these four instincts, that the major instincts that they're talking about, is self-esteem, pocketbooks, ambitions, and personal relationships. They're listed on the bottom of page 64, and they repeat them on the top of page 65. Anytime something was important that Bill Wilson and these guys, the founders, put in there, he would repeat it, sometimes with a different word. When he repeats it on the top of page 65, he adds another word in there, and that's different from 64. It's interfered with. You know, that was my calling card to get mad at a total stranger. I could get a resentment at a total stranger just because he interfered with what I was doing that day. I mean, I could get mad at somebody I'd never seen before just because he got in the way of my mission. But that interfered with is for me was a big deal. That was something I had to limit, you know, to look at it from, why am I mad at this person? I don't even know him. And I had the capability to do that. You just get real angry real fast. I used to get in a lot of fights, got beat up a lot, you know, had a lot of bruises. Just because, and it didn't have to be drunk. I could wake up sober and still get into trouble. And this went on even after I was separated for alcohol for a long time. I can still have my moments today, God willing, that they're getting less and less.
So let's turn now to amends. Can you tell us about the hardest amend that you had to make, and are there any that you haven't made that you wished you had?
There was one chance that I passed up, and I know this person's passed away now, but God usually provides us the opportunity to make the amends that we need to make. There were some, of course, that I couldn't make when I was in the service. I hurt some people pretty bad at different times. One guy, particularly in Hawaii, I had an altercation with him, and he got hurt pretty bad. And it was something that involved my second wife and him, and I just I wish I could have made amends to that guy, but there's no chance that I could ever see him again. Then there was a guy that I used to do a little jogging, and I ran into him. I actually went to jail over the problem that we had, and so I had to do some weekends over that one. And he didn't deserve what he had coming. What I did to him, he didn't deserve that. And I was jogging, and I seen the guy, and I slowed down and stopped, and I went back, and he went back across the street, and I had a chance to catch up with him, and I said, oh, I'll see him again. I never did. I still think that, you know, to this day, I said, I had a chance to make amends to that guy, and I didn't do it. There's some financial amends. There's some guys in Alcoholics Anonymous say, I heard some people at the Alano Club, David used to talk about it a lot, and there was other people. I heard speakers talk about, if you owed money, if somebody gave you some money, and whatever that amount was, if it was $1 million, this guy said, if it was $1 million, he said, they couldn't give it to you unless you had the ability to pay it off. And I had to process that. But then I owed this back child support. And it was a big number. It wasn't $1 million, but it was a big number. And I was running from this, man, because I had this attorney, and I had made it kind of a deal in court on how much I owed and everything, and they agreed to it, and then they come up with a bigger figure, and I said, I'd have hell with them. They ain't going to get nothing. But I was just looking for an excuse not to pay. I was just looking for an excuse not to pay. I inventoried that later on, but I kept listening to the guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would say, there was freedom in... There's a place in there where it talks about in the amends where we negotiate the best deal we can. So I ran with that. So I went down to the child support division and the interest each month on my child support was $200. The interest. So I said, I'll never pay this off. But I said, I'll go down there and negotiate a deal with them, and I'll pay so much a month and just get them off my back. Well, every month when I did, and we come up to a figure, I'd pay them $500 a month. I said, okay. And I was making good money. But every time I would go down there and make one of those payments, it was kind of like, you know, when you go to the road camp and you talk to the guys in the jail or something like that, I get this really elated feeling when I left there. Well, when I would make a payment on that child support each and every month, I would get this elated feeling inside of me. I felt free. But I never thought it was going to get paid off. 5 years, it was gone. It was gone. And probably I wouldn't have been able to do some of the things later on. Because, you know, these guys, they don't ever go away. You know, it's just amazing. But probably the hardest ones was with my mother and my children. Yeah, the really hardest ones, the most difficult ones. And there's some that, there's damage there that I did when those boys were little. I know it was lasting. My oldest boy, there's on my own son. He passed away on my sobriety date, September the 7th, 2017, a little over a year ago. The last 2 years, he basically stayed with me, and he was very sick, and. We talked a lot about some of this stuff, and I know that he still held still had anger towards me. But he was angry too because of his illness, scared. But near the end, the last 6 months he was alive, he had a lot of acceptance of his condition, and he's got two sons, and one of them is 11 years old. He's up in Grass Valley. They're both in Grass Valley. The other one's going to school up there, getting a certificate in one of the colleges for electronics. And I've been communicating with them just this Christmas. But with my children, those amends have been tough. But we have a great, great relationship. I had a daughter by with another woman that was I wasn't married to, and she lives in Oklahoma now with her husband, 10 years. And she graduated from UC Santa Cruz in literature. She taught. She was education administrator for a long time. I didn't have a relationship with her until I got sober. She was about 10 or 11 years old. Her mother passed away when she was 17. And me and her have had a really good relationship since then. She's part of my life. She's part of my kids' life. You know, the boys' life. So I was able to make some amends where I never thought there was any hope, you know, in that area. At least establish a more sound relationship with my children.
Well, Billy, it's hard to wrap up 32 years in an hour or less, right? But we really want to thank you for coming out tonight and sharing some of your experience with us.
Probably.
I think
not.
You told me about it.
Thank you, Billy. Can you give another round of applause? Business meetings are held at 6 p.m. on the last Wednesday of each month. If you consider yourself a member of this group, we invite you to serve our group with your participation.